Nathaniel LaRue, known just, of course, as Nathaniel, is a true South African original. And in a world that uses this word much too much, he is truly a South African icon. And he may be a household name, but he's also a deeply private man. And although he's told stories about his childhood often on stage, he's never written his life story until now. The book is called, not surprisingly, Look at Me. And Nathaniel, welcome. And thank you for joining me in the studio.
Thank you for having me in a building with electricity.
So this is your first full-length memoir. Why now?
They've been begging me for 10 years to do a thing. My life is too boring to write an adult memoir because I just work. So, but I had a fascinating childhood and an exhausting childhood because I had to fight my battles. And I thought I would write a book without my name in, so that it could be any child in the world. Because there are many, many children who have a fear of being, of anything ordinarity. It's not about normality, it's a thing of ordinarity. Is that a word?
Mm.
And that was my instinct from birth, that I'm at the wrong place at the wrong time. So if I could, I mean, I have a lot to say about the inner life of children, but I wanted to write a book that people all over the world can read, not caring who I am or that I have a career or anything, but about parents who have a slightly different child. And that people will know that the inner life of a child is much bigger than what they expect and what they teach them. Children, a lot of the things that your parents teach you, wolves will teach you as well. It's basics. A child learns from experience and from how he feels at his height in this world. And I've been involved with child welfare for years. That's why I've learned a lot about child psychology and about things. And people do not know it. That's the second reason. And the third reason is I want to, before I die, write a novel. That's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. But it's to me, that's the most clever people on earth who can pull off a real novel. And I've done short stories and I've done a text for a long show and stuff like that. But I first needed to prove to myself I can write a book that's not embarrassing. I mean, as far as the writing goes.
I feel as if you've really proven that, Nathaniel, with your short stories. I mean, they are absolutely brilliant. This book
But a short story is a different thing to, because I can tell my whole life as a short story, I think.
Mm.
But then to make it into 6,000 or 60,000 or why many words instead of my normal 3,000 words for a story, that is the thing, because I'm not into detail. I always read D.H. Lawrence because he can go on about what a table looks like in the afternoon sun in a room with a certain temperature for 12 pages, and I just say, he killed him on the table, and then I'm done.
So this book starts with it closes with a striking image, and that's an image of you in your sandpit with your legs, little legs, stuck out in front of you. Mm. And I get a feeling of it being your first self-awareness.
Yes, I, for some reason, I have two cousins that are exactly my age. We're like months apart, and we grew up. They have much or many more memories than I have. I have a theory about that, but their memories start much earlier than mine. I have no memory before that sandpit. I have photographs of 5 years before that, but my first awareness is the smell of that sand, how much discomfort I had in that sand, but I was there every afternoon, and the smell of what the cat did in the sand, and the heat of the afternoon sun in the Swartland. There was a thing. I'm not a summer person, but I remember these things vividly as the beginning. I think maybe before that it was not interesting enough for me, or so I'm too much at the mercy of other people. Before the age of five.
So it was five?
More in my head, four or five. But shortly after that, I went to school. There's not a lot of things. Also, I was in a bubble then. I was uninterrupted before I went to school. My problems start when I had to dress the same as other children and do what they did. And that's where the whole problem came in. But I think my mother and father quickly realized that this is not the firstborn that they have dreamt about. And it's a miracle that they didn't smother me. My dad said to me before he died, it was one of the best things he did was not kill me when he had the chance, because I looked after him for the second part of his life. So he didn't know I was going to make money and be able to care for him. So it is a weird thing. I think if you're a normal Christian people on the Platteland, this, what you see here, is not what you dream as a firstborn son. They calmed down because then the second son came, who was an academic wonder and in sports and masculine and everything, and did everything I was supposed to do. So I think they realized then the problem was not with them, it was with me. So, and then they had three normal children, or three less hysterical children than me.
But you were a musical prodigy.
I was not, I didn't think so, but there were other people who quickly realized that I was musical and that I could do things. That's why my dad bought me a piano. That's the first wonder of my life. That despite being in shock that I put lipstick on a rugby ball and tried to make it a dress, that he still went out and bought me with, they had very little money, but he bought me a piano. Because I think the lady with the Doors that I write about, she had a piano across the street, and she was the organist in the town and the music teacher. And I spent every afternoon in the house, and I just think she needed sleep. Maybe she gave them the money and said, just buy this child a piano. And piano play was when you think about it, it was the last thing I want to do on earth. But in a small town, that's the first sound you hear in church, is that enormous organ playing, that big, majestic sound. And then there is an instrument in your 100 meters from where you live. And that's the only portal you have for something else. It took me decades to realize I don't care very much for the piano. I use it to write songs on, but then I'm done with it. But I studied it because there was nothing else. I was not exposed to, and in my day, you know, it's not like these days you go to school, there's 20 instruments children can study, or ballet or tap, or we had nothing. It was rugby and athletics and the piano. Those were the three things in our town. So I think that's how they discovered. I don't know if they thought I was talented, they just couldn't get me away from the thing.
Well, thank heavens for your grandmother, Nathaniel. What a force of a woman.
Yeah, she was fantastic. I looked at a picture of her yesterday. Very ordinary looking, in the sense of no makeup ever. The jewelry that she had, I think, was there by some miracle for me to wear and to play with. I never saw her with a necklace or anything. She had a brooch that she put on Sundays. But wild in her head, wild she attempted in the 70s to get a motorbike license. I remember she never stopped surprising us. I remember my grandfather would wake up in the mornings and there was just regularly a note, I'm away for 10 days, your food is frozen. And then she was away doing things with people, and she had this way of, I inherited paintings from her, but she had no idea about art, but she had a way of knowing people. And I recently had these three paintings valued, and it's a famous British painter. She came to South Africa to see the country, and her car broke down, and my grandmother gave her food, and then she stayed for a week, and then she gave these paintings to my grandmother, but they're worth a fortune.
Yeah.
My grandmother never knew. She just thought I liked them, so she put my name with plasters behind all her paintings. Where after her death, I got everything. Nobody in the family got anything. So, because I was always there with the stuff. But she was, I just now, 2 weeks ago, at a concert in Oudtshoorn, a lady who knew our family came to me with two letters that she had in a possession from my grandmother. And the one is how my grandmother wrote how I got my piano, and the other one is how my grandmother got a lift to go to Stellenbosch when I was a first-year student to see my first original concert and how impressed she was and how she did not like it, but she loved the fact that the full hall of people applauded. She said she had no idea what I was busy with, but it was fantastic. And she always said it, Omar has no idea what you're doing, but it's unbelievable.
So proud of you.
The freedom that she has as a person.
Because also, Nathaniel, she bought you magazines for you to look at. She bought you paper dolls for you to...
Just paper. She would just buy me... In the, those days, people don't write anymore. You had these writing pads, and some had flowers on it, some had bubbles on it, some had patterns on. She would always take me to Wellington, to the chemist. They had paper. And I was drawn to the paper. And with patterns and things. I don't know why. And I cut it up and I made Christmas decorations. And I just wrote an article about how I still, like an idiot, make Christmas decorations and Christmas cards because that's what I did as a child. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother had a fearless and an individual way of looking at the world. I remember when I was small and TV came out, she made my grandfather buy a black and white TV because it made her fall asleep. She had a problem sleeping. And then she discovered in front of a black and white TV, she would just fall asleep. So she bought one and she slept on the couch. But she never thought that anything she did or I did would be unusual.
Now it seems, was she a matron of a hostel? Because you spent quite a lot, I think you spent your holidays there, didn't you?
No, there were two hostels at the campus of the Huguenot College in Wellington. And the one is a castle. It's a beautiful castle, and people must Google it. It's called Hey Samuel. And there's another one called Clairvaux, two French castles in Wellington. It's imposing buildings. But her best friend was the matron of the other one, where all the students ate. My grandmother and my grandfather had the bottom floor of the castle because my grandfather, there were three campuses in Wellington, there still are, but he was like the factotum of whatever they call it, of them. So they got the bottom floor of this. But when we went there, there were two more stories where girls stayed. Mm. But my grandmother had nothing to do with them. But when we went there, both hostels were empty. So I thought my grandparents lived in a castle because there was the biggest grand piano ever in the biggest sitting room. And my grandmother did not cook for the children that studied, but she had a walk-in fridge, and she had a kitchen as big as this building. So I was used to scale from a very early age, and then all the buildings were always empty at my disposal because my grandfather unlocked them. They had to be cleaned or fixed up. So I was always in the vicinity of pianos or a stage or somewhere where I could do a puppet show. There were all these massive... buildings with carved doors and basements full of antique books and things. And I was always alone there. I left my parents every holiday and went on my own to Wellington to stay with... I couldn't write it in my book, it will kill my mother, but my mother can't cook, she never could. And I was hungry. So I went to Wellington every holiday to eat because my grandmother just cooked.
But you write also about how this has influenced your love of white rooms, for example, but also of symmetry, that in your life you like everything to be symmetrical.
Still, even my shows, people say, why don't you move? But then I break the symmetry on stage. It's like from buildings, from also two other buildings later, when we moved to Portable, I can't remember. I write about other people's symmetrical house. It has always moved me. But the symmetry was easy visible for me because I was alone in these empty buildings. They were not people. People distort pictures. But I was always four holidays a year on this campus where it was me, my grandmother, and my grandfather, and nobody else, with hundreds of rooms and buildings. So you see the path through the lawn in the middle ends at the front door of that enormous house. And the symmetry has always moved me. Mm. And I live like that.
And the majesty of that, the setting.
Yeah.
I just wanted to describe, I want to read out how you describe your grandparents, because I just think it's the most remarkable thing to say about them. My grandparents were a tour de force, a knockout blow, a team of trek oxen, a fit of laughter, a film, a circus, an army, a fort, a season. Sound like remarkable people.
Yes, they were my safety. My grandfather was a bit strange in the way that he did not like individuals. He liked groups. Christmas, when all the, couldn't even remember our names, all of us, they were there, he would tell one story to the room, but that has no personal contact. But he did not mind me, because I was holding my grandmother's dress. I was with my grandmother the whole time I was awake. So only once, I describe it in the book, he was forced to take me with to buy ice cream. And then I watched him buy wine, because he would drink secretly. So, but their space was a safety. And it was because of all the instruments he had in his workshop, and because of all the rolls of fabric for blinds, and all the stuff he had in workshops, and all the stuff my mother had grandmother had in her enormous kitchen. It was like a fairy tale. Well, I was in Santa Claus's workshop kind of thing, and I was always making things and wearing things. And my grandfather would get the shock, because he would go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, and I would be dancing in the passage with flowers on my head and a Spanish skirt. I was doing a concert, and he would just have a fright and never said anything, and then he would just go about his way. But I was always in costume or in something.
You were almost a preternaturally sensitive child, and I mean in terms of being sensitive to light and to sound and to smell, etc. And you write about something that you called the big grey. You had the big grey. Is it too simple to say that that was like a depression that you carried around with you as a child?
It's that knowledge that your spaceship landed somewhere where you don't belong, and they've left, and you're here. It is that feeling of, will I be able to escape other people's routines, eating habits, dress sense, and interior design? Will I be, because I was surrounded by happy, God-fearing, hard-working, Platteland people. And I wanted to be with Queen Elizabeth, getting her ready for another coronation kind of thing. That's where I was in my head. And I could see other beings, and I believed in fairy tales, and I was mesmerized by the Bible. To me, it was the most dramatic book because of all the paintings I had in my children's Bible. So I did not, every morning was a shock. And I went to a school where your jersey was gray and your pants were gray. And those were the years, I can't remember, early 70s, those years when full-length skirts were in fashion. Teachers wore jerseys and then a full-length skirt of the most awful prison fabric. The 70s was not nice as far as fabric and print is concerned. It was the worst time.
Or anything,
yeah,
I can tell
furniture, you. Furniture, yeah. And I grew up in the middle of that awfulness. Maybe in New York they made something of it, or Andy Warhol played with it, but I was in the middle of this very matte world, because none of the fabric in the 70s had a shine to it. This very matte world with A-line, almost brutalist cuts in skirts and dresses and jackets and things. So there was that, the grayness, it was not a depression, it was a very quiet panic that this is how it is in the whole world. This is how it will be forever. Or this is, you know, a child is a powerless thing, because that's why I've only worked for charities. Somebody must look after the dogs and the other one must save the dolphins. I am aware of how powerless children are. And I come from a loved family who loved me and took all the energy to cope with me and the things. But it's hard for a child, because there are rules. 8 o'clock, you have to be in bed. You can't watch that TV program. That magazine is not for children. You can't choose your own clothes. And my mother could not cook. That led to, in high school, to a massive explosion in our house. And halfway through high school, I took over the kitchen. I cooked. My mother never touched things. To this day, she doesn't cook for me. I cooked for her. So that was, she was just not interested in food, in eating, or in cooking it. So, but not as a weird thing. It was just not important to her. If there's a brown bread and there's a tomato and there are five fish fingers on the table, what are you complaining about?
Yeah, it's food.
Yeah. While my grandmother every day cooked as if the Lord was coming to fetch us tonight. She cooked the final banquet every day of her life. And she did it with open doors and windows, so the smell carried through Wellington. And there were always chairs carried from the sitting room into the kitchen where the biggest table was. They were never left. I was, my grandmother cooked so that the poor, the crazy, the hungry, the rich, the lonely, everybody was there. And then I don't, a generation skip things because I also don't look like my parents. My parents are two beautiful people and I have beautiful siblings. My sister was a model and I have my grandmother's face and her shortage of a jaw, her sagging neck, everything I have of my grandmother, and also the love of food. It just skipped my mother.
You have beautiful eyes.
Thank you. It will make the other 99% feel better.
Latanya, let's talk about this photograph on the cover of your book. What was going on there?
That I wrote a chapter about that photograph after I discovered that I still have it. That's why it ended up on the cover. Because that was my first concert, and we didn't have money for costumes. Nobody in the town had. So I was a king in the concert, and my mother made this crown, and we put cotton wool, and then we took my dressing gown, what, kamerias in Afrikaans, with cotton wool. And I didn't want to be the king. I wanted to be the queen or the fairy or the tree, something more pretty. But the excitement of having makeup, and my makeup consisted of a paper moustache, but just having something put on your face. And when I wore that thing until the house was covered in fluff, and then I forced my father to take a picture because he was glad that the concert was over. Now, please get it out of your system. And that was the start of everything for me. I loved applause. I loved, they didn't clap for me because we were in a musical. They clapped for us. But and the decor, and it was all formalite and tacky, but I mean, just the paint and the smell of the whole excitement. So I forced him. My mother said, "You must take the thing off," and I wore it for 3 days until he took the picture. Yeah. And then I forgot that I had it, and then I discovered it when we were done with the book. And then I said, no, this must go on the cover with pieces of the decor drawn as I remember it.
What strikes me is astonishing is that you weren't bullied. You didn't seem to have been bullied at school.
Never.
Or by your brothers. Or
there's one child, I was insulted, and I was skinnered about, if that is Shakespeare. But children feared me. So, because so anything unfamiliar is scary. They don't know if I could zap them into a bottle or do something with them. Also, I was also, it is a strange thing, and I write about it a lot in the book, is that I was a fearful child. I was scared of the world and scared of grown-ups and scared of other children. And I always acted like I was bullied because it was right or normal or expected that it should happen any day now. I am the perfect victim for older boys to bully. But that never stopped me. So I was always the head of every committee. I was always the one who started the drama club, started the school newspaper, started this, did things. So I was very active in a fearless way, trembling inside. But it never stopped me. To this day, I think if I write this, if I wear this, if I say this, there will be repercussions. And then I'm scared, and I said anything on Facebook, but I do not do it. It's a weird thing inside of me, but it was there as a child. But no child has ever touched me or bullied me. I have been insulted behind my back, and I have had anonymous little letters on my bicycle. okay, I expect it because I had a pink bicycle with the purple wheels because my father put a bicycle together from three other old bikes that he found. He was a mechanic and he could do anything. So I had this pink bike with only one gear. I had to step so fast that I was slightly out of focus. And then I'm coming with this pink cloud to the school every morning. So you should insult that if you're normal or need to get it out of your system.
There are some very funny parts, and there are some sad parts in the book, but there's some very, very funny parts as well. For example, the glitter ball was incredibly funny, sad at the same time when you discovered the glitter ball in your town.
Yeah, it was when I discovered that magic is not magic close up, and it is a weird thing. The effect of that, the discovery was a shock, but I never forget the effect of decor and a mirror ball from far. And it's a weird thing. To this day, I've never used electronics or a projection or lasers or anything in any of my productions. I have everything you see is cardboard and paint and fabric. It's still made like Victorians, like there's no development in the world. I still do my shows like that. I just light it cleverly so that it has an effect. But to me, magic is something real because movies has taken it away from us. Since the Transformers and all those things, anything is possible in a movie. So it's impossible. But people still gasp if I can change a costume in 7 seconds or change the scene on stage in 10 seconds. It's something that happens right in front of them. So I've kept that from that shock at the first concerts. But those concerts were my lifeline. Those were the touring days. Oh. You had groups of actors, you had choirs, you had clowns, you had things. The town hall was busy.
Yeah.
They would do town after town and these tacky little circuses that with one thin elephant and a lion whose legs don't work, but they would come to the town and you would go, even if it's just for the smell of popcorn, you would go, and they had an effect on me. And I've learned to not, I never book the first 5 rows in a theater. It takes away all the magic. It's the most expensive seat, and what do? They count my fillings while I sing. There's no magic because you don't see the picture. Sit from the 10th row to the back. The further you move away from the stage, the more magic there is. And that is what I've learned there as a child when I saw beard coming through makeup and saw tackiness of fabrics and pants. If you dance in pants, you know, more than 10 shows, they are tacky. So there's a charm in worn in costumes and memories and stuff in all my costumes. And I've got a few thousand that will be a museum one day or something. But it was a shock the first time because as a child you don't think technically when you first see a thing. It's just there.
Of course, there's that beautiful book, that hardcover book you had a couple of years ago of your costumes.
Closet, yeah.
Another part that was terribly funny were your rugby escapades.
Yeah, it was scary and cruel because I did not dislike anything specifically. I hated the fact that you were forced to do it. That was our only winter sport. I mean, couldn't they just make me paint the school's roof or just something else? But that you had to do it, and then I became legendary. Nobody would touch me because my mother said detergent is expensive, and I could play rugby in the rain in a mud bath and come home with perfectly white shorts. And I would throw the ball to the enemy to stop that they would touch me. And people drove to other towns to see me play. I mean, we were a legendary team because we always lost in the hundreds. We didn't lose we broke world records in. And the favorite, that my only part was, I never knew what they did. Nobody told us. In the middle, when you had interval or whatever they call that thing in the middle, they were always bunched together. And I enjoyed the touching each other part, but I don't know why they bunched together. So we prayed. I led a prayer meeting half time when and I found out later they're discussing tactics or something they're going to do. We would bunch and I would say, Jesus, and then I would go into a prayer. Save us from this. Please let us have our knickknacks on the bus. And the knickknacks just came out at that period, which was the highlight of the trip. It was the knickknacks on the bus on the way back.
Natalia, my only regret about this book is that it ended so quickly. And it ends as you're, I think, just about to go off to university. And I'm hoping that you're planning on the next installment.
It ends when the first person, in the book, it's for sexual reasons, but when the first person looked at me, because people did not look at me. It was a very weird thing. That is why I know what the title would be before I started the book. Because when my parents, when I was small, my parents were very popular. My dad was the joke teller like nobody, and my mother's outgoing and social. So people tolerated me. It was not, you know, an obvious shame their child has only got one foot, but it was a strange child. So they would be nice, when I was on my own, walking through town, and I did that always, people would just be suddenly very busy. They did not want to look at me. Like, I did want to look at certain things that has a grill factor to it. So people never looked at me for years. And then in high school, I lost my baby fat. I started getting attitude. And I was suddenly thin. And I had this wild hairstyle of curly hair that was everywhere like a rock star. And then the book is the first incident that I know that somebody openly stared at me. That's why it ends there. I had to get there to, and I have a therapist who says that I, at a young age, when people laughed at me, I decide one day they will pay for it. So I made it my career. Unconscious me. I couldn't go on with the book because the next people I have to write about are still alive. I can't, they will all sue me. Oh. So these are all dead or missing, or I don't know where they are, but they can't be a high school book. I will be in jail.
Well, now I know why the book's been titled "Look at Me."
Yeah, the book was not it's the final three words of the book, and because that's what happened. But they would not look at me. My uncles, my mother's brothers, would just, even the non-smokers would find a cigarette and go outside. Because I would do these Christmas concerts and I would be Jesus, Mary, Joseph, wise men, and the star. And it was just this pink, fat, strange little child covered in glitter singing Silent Night. And non-smokers just went outside and grabbed a cigarette as not to look. So I understand the whole concept. And it broke my heart later when I understood why they did not look at me. And sometimes I have a hard time because people come to me after shows and see me as their, I don't know what, they're the one who carries the torch because they are tattooed from head to toe. And then I have a problem looking at it. And I have to embrace it. And I have to hug people that I want to run from because they are awkward in their way. And I made it awkwardness profitable, I think, in a lot of people's minds. If he's not dead yet, I have hope. So they come to me after shows and say, you have changed my life, you have saved my life, and then they hug me with purple claws and green tattoos and things. And I understood why people did it, especially those days. I mean, it was in the height of apartheid, and nothing was as conservative. And remember those days where they believe if you play the record the other way, Satan talks to you. Everything was I don't know. It's still, if you walk through a Plateland town in France and Italy, you get those all in black widows who look at you that suspicious way. That was what the times like. And here I just came flying through, trembling with fear, but not playing with dolls.
I think at the end of it, Nathaniel, that you were a very loved child.
I was, and I still am, with my family, and I'm spoiled, and I'm respected, and in my family and my circle of friends, they love me for everything I was not loved for in the book in that period of time. I had to work very hard to prove to people I have the same family values and the same beliefs, and I still believe everything I read in the children's Bible. I didn't go New Age or think it's now in fashion to not believe in anything, or I still have that. I just like wearing makeup so people can at least be sure that's the front, and wear sequins, because if people have the thing of risking a hijacking and having a bath and then coming to a theater, I just need to show them something. I can't stand there like I've just sold insurance and now I have a guitar, you know, that kind of thing. I've always loved that, but I live very simple, almost like the Japanese. I have very few black clothes. I have very few furniture. I have the simplest, minimalist, zen house in the middle of a forest. I eat very simple food. Stage maybe it would be different because the stage gets all of that out of my system. I don't need to have a costume party. I don't need to be drunk at New Year's Eve. I don't need to do what people have the need to do because I do it for a living. So I think I got out of that. It's great that in the third world I have this strange career and that they pay me for it, and then I've been able to just simply manifest all my fantasies mm-hmm. and survive it.
And say, look at me.
Yeah.
Look at me. The book is published by Human and Rousseau, and I'm very reluctant to end this discussion, but I needs must, Nathaniel. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
I didn't even give you a recipe, anything. I'll come back.
You know what I mean? I would love to do with you one day is like a Desert Island Discs, because I was thinking today, I mean, I was wondering what you listen to at home when you're not working, and then I was thinking, you know, the anecdotes that you would maybe link with this. But yes, we haven't even got onto the food, but maybe you can tell me quickly what you're cooking now, what's inspiring you now in terms of food.
At the moment, I have these tiny little obsessions, and my obsession at the moment is lemon. I can't get away from a lemon. It's the most beautiful thing and my favorite flavor. Yesterday, we baked a fantastic lemon zest and blueberry pound cake and covered it in fresh blueberries and stuff like that. And I've just made a beautiful lemon and paprika chicken thing with orange rice molds for the new cook school next Monday or next month. So I have these things. I get obsessed until nobody... Because in my company, we all eat lunch together. It's a rule. We are all together around the table, whether it's business or stuff, but we all eat together every day. But there comes these periods that they say, the one with the most guts will say, is this the last day of lemon? And then I have a new thing. Then it's parsley for 2 months. But I love 2, 3, 4 ingredient meals, not complicated food. I don't enjoy eating out. The best I've ever eaten was at my grandmother's and at my house. I like simple meals with fantastic people. I do set the table like it always looks like Elvis's grave or something. I set these ornate tables and make it very festive and light a million candles and have a butler and a chef and the garden filled with candles, but the food is simple. I do not... I think because life is so hectic, I do not want to be confused by a plate. So and with age, my lifestyle and my needs and my tastes are getting simpler. My housekeeper the other day said, I've just counted, you've got 800 black shirts. Why? You look the same every day. They all look the same. I don't know. I forget that I have them, then I buy them. Mm. It's just a very, very, very simple taste. And then I explode when I write a show or thing. It's like two people, and I think it's healthy for me. Mm.
Thank you very much. Thanks again for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me here and telling people about this book.